do anything right. His home life wasn't any better.
How can you possibly still be an elder in training? His mother fumed night after night at supper. Sometimes she'd let her spoon come crashing down to the table, making the servants jump. My brother promised me that you would be an elder by now. He promised!
And she would seethe and grumble until Antane's youngest brother, Wynn, began to cry. Antane was the oldest of six brothers, a small family by protectorate standards, and ever since his father died, his mother wanted nothing else but to make sure that each of her sons achieved the very best that the protectorate had to offer. Because didn't she, after all, deserve the very best when it came to sons?
"Uncle tells me that things take time, Mother," Antane said quietly. He pulled his toddler brother onto his lap and began rocking until the child calmed. He pulled a wooden toy that he had carved himself from his pocket, a little crow with spiral eyes and a clever rattle inside its belly. The boy was delighted and instantly shoved it into his mouth.
"Your uncle can boil his head," she fumed. "We deserve that honor. I mean, you deserve it, my dear son."
Antane wasn't so sure. He excused himself from the table, mumbling something about having work to do for the council, but really he only planned on sneaking into the kitchen to help the kitchen staff, and then into the gardens to help the gardeners in the last of the daylight hours. And then he went into the shed to carve wood. Antane loved woodworking. The stability of the material, the delicate beauty of the grain, the comforting smell of sawdust and oil. There were few things in his life that he loved more. He carved and worked deep into the night, trying his best not to think about his life. The next day of sacrifice was approaching, after all, and Antane would need yet another excuse to make himself scarce. The next morning, Antane donned his freshly laundered robe and headed into the council hall well before dawn. Every day, his first task of the morning was to read through the citizen complaints and requests that had been scrawled with bits of chalk on the large slate wall, and deem which ones were worth attention and which should simply be washed down and erased.
"But what if they all are important, Uncle?" Antane had asked the Grand Elder once.
"They can't possibly be. In any case, by denying access, we give our people a gift. They learn to accept their lot in life. They learn that any action is inconsequential. Their days remain, as they should be, cloudy. There is no greater gift than that. Now, where is my Zirin tea?"
Next, Antane was to air out the room, then post the day's agendas, then fluff the cushions for the elders' bony bottoms, then spray the entrance room with some kind of perfume concocted in the laboratories of the Sisters of the Star, designed, apparently, to make people feel wobbly-kneed and tongue-tied and frightened and grateful all at once. And then he was to stand in the room as the servants arrived, giving each one an imperious expression as they entered the building, before hanging up his robes in the closet and going to school.
"But what if I don't know how to make an imperious expression, Uncle?"
the boy asked again and again.
"Practice, nephew. Continue to practice."
Antane walked slowly toward the schoolhouse, enjoying the temporary glimmers of sun overhead. It would be cloudy in an hour. It was always cloudy in the Protectorate. Fog clung to the city walls and cobbled streets like tenacious moss. Not many people were out and about that early in the morning. Pity, thought Antane. They're missing the sunlight. He lifted his face and felt that momentary rush of hope and promise. He let his eyes drift toward the tower, its black, devilishly complicated stonework mimicking the whorls of galaxies and the trajectories of stars, its small, round windows winking outward like eyes. That mother, the one who went mad, was still in there, locked up, the mad woman. For 5 years now she had convalesced in confinement, but she still had not healed. In Antane's mind's eye he could see that wild face, those black eyes, that birthmark on her forehead, livid and red, the way she kicked and climbed and shrieked and fought. He couldn't forget it. And he couldn't forgive himself. Antane shut his eyes tight and tried to force the image away.
"Why must this go on?" His heart continued to ache.
There must be another way.
As usual, he was the first one to arrive at school. Even the teacher wasn't there. He sat on the stoop and took out his journal. He was done with his schoolwork. Not that it mattered. His teacher insisted on calling him Elder Antane in a breathy, fawning voice, even though he wasn't an elder yet, and gave him top marks no matter what kind of work he did. He could likely turn in blank pages and still get top marks. Antane still worked hard in spite of that. His teacher, he knew, was just hoping for special treatment later. In his journal, he had several sketches of a project of his own design, a clever cabinet to house and neatly organize garden tools, situated on wheels so that it could be pulled easily by a small goat, a gift intended for the head gardener, who was always kind. A shadow fell across his work.
"Nephew,"
the grand elder said. Antane's head went up like a shot.
"Uncle,"
he said, scrambling to his feet, accidentally dropping his papers, scattering them across the ground. He hurriedly gathered them back up into his arms. Grand Elder Gerland rolled his eyes.
"Come, nephew,"
the grand elder said with a swish of his robes, motioning for the boy to follow him.
"You and I must talk."
"But what about school?"
"There is no need to be in school in the first place. The purpose of this structure is to house and amuse those who have no futures until they are old enough to work for the benefit of the Protectorate. People of your stature have tutors. And why you have refused such a basic thing is beyond comprehension. Your mother prattles on about it endlessly. In any case, you will not be missed."
This was true. He would not be missed. Every day in class, Antane sat in the back and worked quietly. He rarely asked questions. He rarely spoke. Especially now, since the one person whom he wouldn't have minded speaking to, and even better if she spoke back to him in return, had left school entirely. She had joined the novitiate at the Sisters of the Star. Her name was Athene, and though Antane had never exchanged three words in succession with her, still he missed her desperately, and now only went to school day after day on the wild hope that she would change her mind and come back. It had been a year. No one ever left the Sisters of the Star. It wasn't done. Yet Antane continued to wait and hope. He followed his uncle at a run. The other elders still had not arrived at the council hall, and likely would not until noon or later, Gerland told Antane to sit. The grand elder stared at Antane for a long time. Antane couldn't get the tower out of his mind, or the mad woman, or the baby left in the forest, whimpering piteously as they walked away. And oh, how that mother screamed. And oh, how she fought. And oh, what have we become? It pierced Antane every day, a great needle in his soul.
"Nephew,"
the grand elder said at last. He folded his hands and brought them to his mouth. He sighed deeply. Antane realized that his uncle's face was pale.
"The day of sacrifice approaches."
"I know, uncle," Antane said. His voice was thin. "5 days, it..."
He sighed.
"It waits for no one."
"You were not there last year. You were not standing with the other elders. An infection in your foot, as I recall."
Antane tilted his gaze to the ground.
"Yes, uncle. I had a fever, too."
"And it resolved itself the next day?"
"Bog be praised," he said weakly. "It was a miracle."
"And the year before," Gerland said, "it was pneumonia, was it?"
Antane nodded. He knew where this was going.
"And before that, a fire in the shed, is that right? Good thing no one was injured. And there you were, all by yourself, fighting the fire."
"Everyone else was along the route," Antane said. "No shirkers, so I was alone."
"Indeed."
Grand Elder Gerland gave Antane a narrowed look.
"Young man," he said, "who on earth do you think you're fooling?"
A silence fell between them. Antane remembered the little black curls framing those wide black eyes. He remembered the sounds the baby made when they left her in the forest. He remembered the thud of the tower doors when they locked the madwoman inside. He shivered.
"Uncle," Antane began,
but Gerland waved him off.
"Listen, nephew. It was against my better judgment to offer you this position. I did so not because of the incessant needling of my sister, but because of the great love I had and have for your dear father," that he rest easily. "He wanted to make sure your path was assured before he passed away, and I could not deny him. And having you here..."
The hard lines of Gerland's face softened a bit.
"Has been an antidote to my own sadness. And I appreciate it. You are a good boy, Antane. Your father would be proud."
Antane found himself relaxing, but only for a moment. With a broad sweep of robes, the Grand Elder rose to his feet.
"But,"
he said, his voice reverberating strangely in the small room,
"my affection for you only goes so far."
There was, in his voice, a brittle edge. His eyes were wide, strained, even a bit wet. "Is my uncle worried about me?" Antane wondered. "Surely not," he thought.
"Young man," his uncle continued, "this cannot go on. The other elders are muttering. They..."
He paused, his voice caught in his throat. His cheeks were flushed.
"They aren't happy. My protection over you extends far, my dear, dear boy, but it is not infinite."
"Why would I need to be protected?" Antane wondered as he stared at his uncle's strained face. The Grand Elder closed his eyes and calmed his ragged breathing. He motioned for the boy to stand. His face resumed its imperious expression.
"Come, nephew. It's time for you to return to school. We shall expect you, as usual, at mid-afternoon. I do hope you are able to make at least one person grovel today. It would put to rest so many misgivings among the other elders. Promise me you'll try, Antane. Please."
Antane shuffled toward the door, the Grand Elder gliding just behind. The older man lifted his hand to rest on the boy's shoulder and let it hover just above for a moment before thinking better of it and letting it drift back down. "I'll try harder, Uncle," Antane said as he walked out the door. "I promise I will."
"See that you do,"
the Grand Elder said in a hoarse whisper. 5 days later, as the robes swept through the town toward the cursed house, Antane was home, sick to his stomach, vomiting his lunch. Or so he said. The other elders grumbled during the entire procession. They grumbled as they retrieved the child from its pliant parents. They grumbled as they hurried toward the sycamore grove. "The boy will have to be dealt with," the elders muttered, and each one knew exactly what that meant.
"Oh, Antane, my boy, my boy. Oh, Antane, my boy,"
Gerland thought as they walked, tendrils of worry curling around his heart, cinching into a hard, tight knot.
"What have you done, you foolish child? What have you done?"
Chapter 7, in which a magical child is more troubled by half. When Luna was 5 years old, her magic had doubled itself 5 times, but it remained inside her, fused to her bones and muscles and blood. Indeed, it was inside every cell, inert, unused, all potential and no force.
"It can't go on like this," Glurk fussed. "The more magic she gathers, the more magic will spill out."
He made funny faces at the girl in spite of himself. Luna giggled like mad.
"You mark my words," he said, vainly trying to be serious.
"You don't know that," Zan said. "Maybe it will never come out. Maybe things will never be difficult."
Despite her tireless work finding homes for abandoned babies, Zan had a deep loathing for difficult things, and sorrowful things, and unpleasant things. She preferred not to think of them if she could help it. She sat with the girl, blowing bubbles. Lovely, lurid, mostly magical things, with pretty colors swirling on their surfaces. The girl chased and caught each bubble on her fingers, and set each of them surrounding daisy blossoms or butterflies or the leaves of trees. She even climbed inside a particularly large bubble and floated just over the tips of the grass.
"There is so much beauty, Glurk," Zan said. "How can you possibly think about anything else?"
Glurk shook his head.
"How long can this last, Zan?" Glurk said.
The witch refused to answer. Later, he held the girl and sang her to sleep. He could feel the heft of the magic in his arms. He could feel the pulse and undulation of those great waves of magic surging inside the child, never finding their way to shore. The witch told him he was imagining things. She insisted that they focus their energies on raising a little girl who was, by nature, a tangle of mischief and motion and curiosity. Each day, Luna's ability to break rules in new and creative ways was an astonishment to all who knew her. She tried to ride the goats, tried to roll boulders down the mountain and into the side of the barn. For decoration, she explained, tried to teach the chickens to fly, and once almost drowned in the swamp. Glurk saved her, thank goodness. She gave ale to the geese to see if it made them walk funny. It did. And put peppercorns in the goat's feed to see if it would make them jump. They didn't jump, they just destroyed the fence. Every day she goaded Furion into making atrocious choices, or she played tricks on the poor dragon, making him cry. She climbed, hid, built, broke, wrote on the walls, and spoiled dresses when they had only just been finished. Her hair ratted, her nose smudged, and she left handprints wherever she went.
"What will happen when her magic comes?" Glurk asked again and again. "What will she be like then?"
Zan tried not to think about it. Zan visited the Free Cities twice a year, once with Luna and once without. She did not explain to the child the purpose for her solo visit, nor did she tell her about the sad town on the other side of the forest, or of the babies left in that small clearing, presumably to die. She'd have to tell the girl eventually, of course. One day, Zan told herself, not now. It was too sad, and Luna was too little to understand. When Luna was 5, she traveled once again to one of the farthest of the Free Cities, a town called Obsidian, and Zan found herself fussing at a child who would not sit quietly, not for anything.
"Young lady, will you please remove yourself from this house at once and go find a friend to play with?" "Grandmama, look, it's a hat."
And she reached into the bowl and pulled out the lump of rising bread dough and put it on her head.
"It's a hat, Grandmama, the prettiest hat."
"It is not a hat," Zan said. "It is a lump of dough." She was in the middle of a complex bit of magic. The schoolmistress lay on the kitchen table, deep in sleep. And Zan kept both palms on the sides of the young woman's face, concentrating hard. The schoolmistress had been suffering from terrible headaches that were, Zan discovered, the result of a growth in the center of her brain. Zan could remove it with magic, bit by bit, but it was tricky work and dangerous. Work for a clever witch, and none was more clever than Zan. Still, the work was difficult. More difficult than she felt it should have been. And taxing. Everything was taxing lately. Zan blamed old age. Her magic emptied so quickly these days, and took so long to refill. And she was so tired.
"Young man," Zan said to the schoolmistress's son, a nice boy, 15 probably, whose skin seemed to glow, one of the star children. "Will you please take this troublesome child outside and play with her so I may focus on healing your mother without killing her by mistake?"
The boy turned pale.
"I'm only kidding, of course. Your mother is safe with me."
Zan hoped that was true. Luna slid her hand into the boy's hand, her black eyes shining like jewels.
"Let's play," she said,
and the boy grinned back. He loved Luna just like everyone else did. They ran, laughing, out the door and disappeared into the woods out back. Later, when the growth had been dispatched and the brain healed and the schoolmistress was sleeping comfortably, Zan felt she could finally relax. Her eye fell on the bowl on the counter, the bowl with the rising bread dough. But there was no bread dough in the bowl at all. Instead, there was a hat, wide-brimmed and intricately detailed. It was the prettiest hat Zan had ever seen. "Oh, dear," Zan whispered, picking up the hat and noticing the magic laced within it. Blue, with a shimmer of silver at the edges. Luna's magic. "Oh, dear. Oh, dear." Over the next 2 days, Zan did her best to conclude her work in the Free Cities as quickly as she could. Luna was no help at all. She ran circles around the other children, racing and playing and jumping over fences. She dared groups of children to climb to the tops of trees with her, or into barn lofts, or onto the ridgepoles of neighborhood roofs. They followed her higher and higher, but they couldn't follow her all the way. She seemed to float above the branches. She pirouetted on the tip of a birch leaf. "Come down this instant, young lady," the witch hollered. The little girl laughed. She flitted toward the ground, leaping from leaf to leaf, guiding the other children safely behind her. Zan could see the tendrils of magic fluttering behind her like ribbons, blue and silver, silver and blue. They billowed and swelled and spiraled in the air. They left their etchings on the ground. Zan took off after the child at a run, cleaning up as she did so. A donkey became a toy. A house became a bird. A barn was suddenly made of gingerbread and spun sugar. "She has no idea what she is doing," Zan thought. The magic poured out of the girl. Zan had never seen so much in all her life. "She could so easily hurt herself," Zan fussed, "or someone else, or everyone in town." Zan tore down the road, her old bones groaning, undoing spell after spell before she caught up to the wayward girl. "Nap time," the witch said, brandishing both palms, and Luna collapsed onto the ground. She had never interfered in the will of another, never. Years ago, almost 500, she made a promise to her guardian, Zazimos, that she never would. But now... "What have I done?" Zan asked herself. She thought she might be sick. The other children stared. Luna snored. She left a puddle of drool on the ground. "Is she all right?" one boy asked. Zan picked Luna up, feeling the weight of the child's face on her shoulder and pressing her wrinkled cheek against the little girl's hair. "She's fine, dear," she said. "She's just sleepy. She is so sleepy. And I do believe you have chores to do." Zan carried Luna to the guest house of the mayor, where they happened to be staying. Luna slept deeply. Her breathing was slow and even. The crescent moon birthmark on her forehead glowed a bit. A pink moon. Zan smoothed the child's black hair away from her face, winding her fingers in the shining curls. "What have I been missing?" she asked herself out loud. There was something she wasn't seeing, something important. She didn't think about her childhood if she could help it. It was too sad, and sorrow was dangerous, though she couldn't quite remember why. Memory was a slippery thing, slick moss on an unstable slope, and it was ever so easy to lose one's footing and fall. And anyway, 500 years was an awful lot to remember. But now her memories came tumbling toward her. A kindly old man, a decrepit castle, a clutch of scholars with their faces buried in books, a mournful mother dragon saying goodbye. And something else, too. Something scary. Zan tried to pluck the memories as they tumbled by, but they were like bright pebbles in an avalanche. They flashed briefly in the light, and then they were gone. There was something she was supposed to remember. She was sure of it. If she could only remember what. Chapter 8. In which a story contains a hint of truth. A story, Fine. I will tell you a story. But you won't like it. And it will make you cry. Once upon a time, there were good wizards and good witches, and they lived in a castle in the center of the wood. Well, of course, the forest wasn't dangerous in those days. We know who is responsible for cursing the forest. It is the same person who steals our children and poisons the water. In those days, the protectorate was prosperous and wise. No one needed the road to cross the forest. The forest was a friend to all, and anyone could walk to the enchanter's castle for remedies or advice or general gossip. But one day, an evil witch rode across the sky on the back of a dragon. She wore black boots and a black hat and a dress the color of blood. She howled her rage to the sky. Yes, child, this is a true story. What other kinds of stories are there? As she flew on her cursed dragon, the land rumbled and split. The rivers boiled and the mud bubbled, and entire lakes turned into steam. The bog, our beloved bog, became toxic and rank, and people died because they couldn't get air. The land under the castle swelled. It rose and rose and rose, and great plumes of smoke and ash came billowing from its center. "It's the end of the world," people cried. And it might have been, if one good man had not dared to stand up to the witch. One of the good wizards from the castle, no one remembers his name, saw the witch on her fearsome dragon as they flew across the broken land. He knew what the witch was trying to do. He wanted to pull the fire from the bulge of the earth and spread it across the land like a cloth over a table. She wanted to cover us all in ash and fire and smoke. Well, of course that's what she wanted. No one knows why. How could we? She's a witch. She needs no rhyme and no reason neither. Of course this is a true story. Haven't you been listening? And so the brave little wizard, ignoring his own great peril, ran into the smoke and flame. He leaped into the air and pulled the witch from the back of her dragon. He threw the dragon into the flaming hole in the earth, stopping it up like a cork in a bottle. But he didn't kill the witch. The witch killed him instead. This is why it doesn't pay to be brave. Bravery makes nothing, protects nothing, results in nothing. It only makes you dead. And this is why we don't stand up to the witch. Because even a powerful old wizard was no match for her. I already told you this story is true. I only tell true stories. Now, off with you. And don't let me catch you shirking on your chores. I might send you to the witch and have her deal with you. Chapter 9, in which several things go wrong. The journey home was a disaster.
"Grandmama," Luna cried, "a bird!"
And a tree stump became a very large, very pink, and very perplexed-looking bird who sat sprawled on the ground, wings akimbo, as if shocked by its own existence. Which, Zan reasoned, the poor thing probably was. She transformed it back into a stump the moment the child wasn't looking. Even from that great distance, she could sense its relief.
"Grandmama!"
Luna shrieked, running up ahead.
"Cake!"
And the stream up ahead suddenly ceased. The water vanished and became a long river of cake.
"Yummy!"
Luna cried, grabbing cake by the handful, smearing multicolored icing across her face. Zan hooked her arm around the girl's waist, vaulted over the cake stream with her staff, and shooed Luna forward along the winding path up the slope of the mountain, undoing the accidental spell over her shoulder.
"Grandmama, butterflies! Grandmama, a pony! Grandmama, berries!"
Spell after spell erupted from Luna's fingers and toes, from her ears and eyes. Her magic skittered and pulsed. It was all Zan could do to keep up. At night, after falling into an exhausted heap, Zan dreamed of Zazimos the wizard, dead now these 500 years. In her dream, he was explaining something important, but his voice was obscured by the rumble of the volcano. She could only focus on his face as it wrinkled and withered in front of her eyes, his skin collapsing like the petals of a lily drooping at the end of the day. When they arrived back at their home, nestled beneath the peaks and craters of the sleeping volcano and wrapped in the lush smell of the swamp, Vlerk stood at his full height waiting for them. "Zan," he said, as Firion danced and spun in the air, screeching a newly created song about his love for everyone that he knew.
"It seems our girl has become more complicated."
He had seen the strands of magic skittering this way and that, and launching in long threads over the tops of the trees. He knew, even at that great distance, that he wasn't seeing Zan's magic, which was green and soft and tenacious, the color and texture of lichen clinging to the lee of the oaks. No, this was blue and silver. Silver and blue. Luna's magic. Zan waved him off. "You don't know the half of it," she said, as Luna went running to the swamp to gather the irises into her arms and drink in the scent. As Luna ran, each footstep blossomed with iridescent flowers. When she waded into the swamp, the reeds twisted themselves into a boat, and she climbed aboard, floating across the deep red of the algae coating the water. Firion settled himself at the prow. He didn't seem to notice that anything was amiss. Zan curled her arm across Glurk's back and leaned against him. She was more tired than she'd ever been in her life. "This is going to take some work," she said. Then, leaning heavily on her staff, Zan made her way to the workshop to prepare to teach Luna. It was, as it turned out, an impossible task. Zan had been 10 years old when she was in magicked. Until then, she had been alone and frightened. The sorcerers who studied her weren't exactly kind. One in particular seemed to hunger for sorrow. When Zazimos rescued her and bound her to his allegiance and care, she was so grateful that she was ready to follow any rule in the world. Not so with Luna. She was only 5, and remarkably bullheaded.
"Sit still, precious," Zan said over and over and over as she tried to get the girl to direct her magic at a single candle. "We need to look inside the flame in order to understand that—" "Young lady, no flying in the classroom." "I'm a crow, Grandmama," Luna cried, which wasn't entirely true. She had simply grown black wings and proceeded to flap about the room.
"Caw, caw, caw," she cried.
Zan snatched the child out of the air and undid the transformation. Such a simple spell, but it knocked Zan to her knees. Her hands shook and her vision clouded over.
"What is happening to me?"
Zan asked herself. She had no idea. Luna didn't notice. She transformed a book into a dove and enlivened her pencils and quills so that they stood on their own and performed a complicated dance on the desk.
"Luna, stop!"
Zan said, putting a simple blocking spell on the girl, which should have been easy, and should have lasted at least an hour or two. But the spell ripped from Zan's belly, making her gasp, and then didn't even work. Luna broke through the block without a second thought. Zan collapsed onto a chair.
"Go outside and play, darling," the old woman said, her body shaking all over. "But don't touch anything, and don't hurt anything, and no magic."
"What's magic, Grandmama?"
Luna asked as she raced out the door. There were trees to climb and boats to build, and Zan was fairly certain she saw the child talking to a crane. Each day the magic became more unruly. Luna bumped tables with her elbows and accidentally transformed them to water. She transformed her bedclothes to swans while she slept. They made an awful mess. She made stones pop like bubbles. Her skin became so hot it gave Zan blisters, or so cold that she made a frostbitten imprint of her body on Glurk's chest when she gave him a hug. And once, she made one of Firion's wings disappear in mid-flight, causing him to fall. Luna skipped away, utterly unaware of what she had done. Zan tried encasing Luna in a protective bubble, telling her it was a fun game they were playing, just to keep all that surging power contained. She cast bubbles around Furion, and bubbles around the goats, and bubbles around each chicken, and a very large bubble around the house, lest she accidentally allow their home to burst into flames. And the bubbles held. They were strongly magic, after all. Until they didn't.
"Make more, Grandmama!" Luna cried,
running in circles on the stones, each of her footprints erupting in green plants and lurid flowers.
"More bubbles!"
Zan had never been so exhausted in her life.
"Take Furion to the South Crater," Zan told Glurk, after a week of backbreaking labor and little sleep. She had dark circles under her eyes. Her skin was as pale as paper.
Glurk shook his massive head. "I can't leave you like this, Zan," he said as Luna made a cricket grow to the size of a goat. She gave it a lump of sugar that had appeared in her hand and climbed aboard its back for a ride.
Glurk shook his head. "How could I possibly?"
"I need to keep the both of you safe," Zan said.
The swamp monster shrugged.
"Magic has nothing on me," he said. "I've been around for far longer than it has."
Zan wrinkled her brow.
"Perhaps, but I don't know. She has so much, and she has no idea what she's doing."
Her bones felt thin and brittle, and her breath rattled in her chest. She did her best to hide this from Glurk. Zan followed Luna from place to place, undoing spell after spell. The wings were removed from the goats. The eggs were untransformed from muffins. The treehouse stopped floating. Luna was both amazed and delighted. She spent her days laughing and sighing and pointing with wonder. She danced about, and where she danced, fountains erupted from the ground. Meanwhile, Zan grew weaker and weaker. Finally, Glurk couldn't stand it anymore. Leaving Furion at the crater's edge, he galumphed down to his beloved swamp. After a quick dip in the murky waters, he made his way toward Luna, who was standing by herself in the yard.
"Glurk!" she called. "I'm so happy to see you. You are as cute as a bunny."
And just like that, Glurk was a bunny. A fluffy, white, pink-eyed bunny with a puff for a tail. He had long white lashes and fluted ears, and his nose quivered in the center of his face. Instantly, Luna began to cry. Zan came running out of the house and tried to make out what the sobbing girl had told her. By the time she began to look for Glurk, he was gone. He had hopped away, having no idea who he was or what he was. He had been enrabbited. It took hours to find him. Zan sat the girl down. Luna stared at her.
"Grandmama, you look different."
And it was true. Her hands were gnarled and spotted. Her skin hung on her arms. She could feel her face folding over itself and growing older by the moment. And in that moment, sitting in the sun with Luna and the rabbit that once was Glurk shivering between them, Zan could feel it. The magic in her bending toward Luna, just as the moonlight had bent toward the girl when she was still a baby. And as the magic flowed from Zan to Luna, the old woman grew older and older, and older.
"Luna," Zan said, stroking the ears of the bunny.
"Do you know who this is?"
"It's Glurk," Luna said, pulling the rabbit onto her lap and cuddling it affectionately.
Zan nodded.
"How do you know it is Glurk?"
Luna shrugged.
"I saw Glurk, and then he was a bunny."
"Ah," Zan said. "Why do you think he became a bunny?"
Luna smiled.
"Because bunnies are wonderful, and he wanted to make me happy. Clever Glurk."
Zan paused.
"But how, Luna? How did he become a bunny?"
She held her breath. The day was warm, and the air was wet and sweet. The only sounds were the gentle gurgling of the swamp. The birds in the forest quieted down, as if to listen.
Luna frowned. "I don't know. He just did."
Zan folded her knotty hands together and pressed them to her mouth.
I see, she said.
She focused on the magic stores deep within her body and noticed, sadly, how depleted they were. She could fill them up, of course, with both starlight and moonlight and any other magic that she could find lying around, but something told her it would only be a temporary solution. She looked at Luna and pressed her lips to the child's forehead.
Sleep, my darling.
Your grandmama needs to learn some things.
Sleep. 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 Sleep.
And the girl slept. Zan nearly collapsed from the effort of it, but there wasn't time for that. She turned her attention to Glurk. Analyzing the structure of the spell that had enrabbited him, undoing it bit by bit.
Why do I want a carrot?
Glurk asked. The witch explained the situation. Glurk was not amused.
Don't even start with me, Zan snapped.
There's nothing to say, Glurk said. We both love her. She is family. But what now?
Zan pulled herself to her feet, her joints creaking and cracking like rusty gears.
I hate to do this, but it's for all our sakes. She's a danger to herself, she's a danger to all of us. She has no idea what she's doing, and I don't know how to teach her. Not now. Not when she's so young and impulsive and Luna-ish.
Zan stood, rolled her shoulders, and braced herself. She made a bubble and hardened the bubble into a cocoon around the girl, adding bright threads winding around and around.
She can't breathe,
Glurk said, suddenly alarmed.
She doesn't need to, Zan said. She is in stasis, and the cocoon holds her magic inside.
She closed her eyes.
Zazimos used to do this to me when I was a child. Probably for the same reason.
Lurk's face clouded over. He sat heavily on the ground, curling his thick tail around him like a cushion.
I remember. All at once.
He shook his head.
Why had I forgotten?
Zan pushed her wrinkled lips to one side.
Sorrow is dangerous. Or at least it was. I can't remember why now.
I think we both became accustomed to not remembering things. We just let things get foggy. Glurk guessed it was something more than that, but he let the matter drop.
Therion will be coming down after a bit, I expect, Zan said. He can't stand being alone for too long. I don't think it matters, but don't let him touch Luna, just in case.
Glurk reached out and laid his great hand on Zan's shoulder.
But where are you going?
To the old castle, Zan said.
But
Glurk stared at her.
There's nothing there, just a few old stones.
I know, Zan said. I just need to stand there, in that place, where I last saw Zazimos and Firion's mother and the rest of them. I need to remember things, even if it makes me sad.
Leaning heavily on her staff, Zan began hobbling away.
I need to remember a lot of things, she muttered to herself. Everything. Right now.
Chapter 10, in which a witch finds a door and a memory, too. Zan turned her back on the swamp and followed the trail up the slope toward the crater where the volcano had opened its face to the sky so long ago. The trail had been fashioned with large, flat rocks inlaid into the ground and fitted so close to one another that the seam between them could hardly let in a piece of paper. It had been years since Zan last walked this trail. Centuries, really. She shivered. Everything looked so different, and yet not. There had been a circle of stones in the courtyard of the castle once upon a time. They had surrounded the central, older tower like sentinels, and the castle had wrapped around the whole of it like a snake eating its tail. But the tower was gone now, although Zan had no idea where, and the castle was rubble, and the stones had been toppled by the volcano, or swallowed up by the earthquake, or crumbled by fire and water and time. Now there was only one, and it was difficult to find. Tall grasses surrounded it like a thick curtain, and ivy clung to its face. Zan spent well over half a day just trying to find it, and once she did, it was a full hour of hard labor just to dislodge the lattice of persistent ivy. When she got down to the stone itself, she was disappointed. There were words carved into the flat of the stone, a simple message on each side. Zazimos himself had carved it long ago. He had carved it for her when she was still a child. "Don't forget," it said on one side of the stone. "I mean it," it said on the other.
"Don't forget what?"
"You mean what, Zazimos?"
She wasn't sure.
Despite the spottiness of her memories, one thing she did remember was his tendency toward the obscure. And his assumption that because vague words and insinuations were clear enough for him, they must be perfectly comprehensible to all. And after all these years, Zan remembered how annoying she had found it then.
"Confound that man," she said.
She approached the stone and leaned her forehead against the deeply carved words, as if the stone might be Zazimos himself. "Oh, Zazimos," she said, feeling a surge of emotion that she hadn't felt in nearly 5 centuries.
"I'm sorry. I've forgotten. I didn't mean to, but..."
The surge of magic hit her like a falling boulder, knocking her backward. She landed with a thud on her creaking hips. She stared at the stone, open-mouthed.
"The stone isn't magicked," she thought to herself. "Of course."
And she looked up at the stone just as a seam appeared down the middle and the two sides swung inward like great stone doors.
"Not like stone doors," Zan thought. "They are stone doors."
The shape of the stone still stood like a doorway against the blue sky, but the entrance itself opened into a very dim corridor where a set of stone steps disappeared into the dark. And in a flash, Zan remembered that day. She was 13 years old and terribly impressed with her own witchy cleverness, and her teacher, once so strong and powerful, was fading by the day.
"Be careful of your sorrow," he had said.
He was so old then, impossibly old. He was all angles and bones and papery skin, like a cricket.
"Your sorrow is dangerous. Don't forget that she is still about."
And so Zan had swallowed her sorrow, and her memories, too. She buried both so deep that she would never find them. Or so she thought. But now she remembered the castle. She remembered its crumbly strangeness, its nonsensical corridors, and the people who lived in the castle, not just the wizards and scholars, but the cooks and scribes and assistants as well. She remembered how they scattered into the forest when the volcano erupted. She remembered how she put protective spells on each of them, well, each of them but one, and prayed to the stars that each spell would hold as they ran. She remembered how Zazimos hid the castle within each stone in the circle. Each stone was a door.
"Same castle, different doors. Don't forget. I mean it."
"I won't forget," she said at 13.
"You will surely forget, Zan. Have you not met yourself?"
He was so old then. How did he get so old? He had practically withered to dust.
"But not to worry. I have built that into the spell. Now, if you don't mind, my dear, I have treasured knowing you, and lamented knowing you, and found myself laughing in spite of myself each day we were together. But that is all past now, and you and I must part. I have many thousands of people to protect from that blasted volcano, and I do hope you'll make sure they are ever so thankful, won't you, dear?"
He shook his head sadly.
"What am I saying? Of course you won't."
and he and the simply enormous dragon disappeared into the smoke and plunged themselves into the heart of the mountain, stopping the eruption, forcing the volcano into a restless sleep. And both were gone forever. Zan never did anything to protect his memory or to explain what he had done. Indeed, within a year, she could barely remember him. It never occurred to her to find it strange. The part of her that would have found it strange was on the other side of the curtain, lost in the fog. She peered into the gloom of the hidden castle. Her old bones ached, and her mind raced. Why had her memories hidden themselves from her? And why had Zazimos hidden the castle? She didn't know, but she was certain where she would find the answer. She knocked her staff against the ground 3 times until it produced enough light to illuminate the dark. And she walked into the stone. Chapter 11, in which a witch comes to a decision. Zan gathered books by the armload and carried them from the ruined castle to her workshop. Books and maps and papers and journals, diagrams, recipes, artwork. For 9 days she neither slept nor ate. Luna remained in her cocoon, pinned in place, pinned in time, too. She didn't breathe. She didn't think. She was simply paused. Every time Glurk looked at her, he felt a sharp stab in his heart. He wondered if it would leave a mark. He needn't have wondered. It surely did. "You cannot come in," Zan told him through the locked door. "I must focus." And then he heard her muttering inside. Night after night, Glurk peered into the windows of the workshop, watching as Zan lit her candles and scanned through hundreds of open books and documents, taking notes on a scroll that grew longer and longer by the hour, muttering all the while. She shook her head. She whispered spells into lead boxes, quickly slamming the door shut the moment the spell was uttered and sitting on the lid to hold it in. Afterward, she'd cautiously open the box and peek inside, inhaling deeply as she did so through her nose. "Cinnamon," she'd say, "and salt. Too much wind in the spell." And she'd write that down. Or, "Methane. No good. She'll accidentally fly away. Plus she'll be flammable, even more than usual." Or, "Is that sulfur? Great heavens, what are you trying to do, woman? Kill the poor child?" She crossed several things off her list.
"Has Auntie Zan gone mad?" Firion asked.
"No, my friend," Glurk told him. "But she has found herself in deeper water than she expected. She is not accustomed to not knowing exactly what to do, and it's frightening to her. As the poet says, the fool, when removed from solid ground, leaps from mountain top to burning star to black, black space. The scholar, when bereft of scroll, of quill, of heavy tome, falls and cannot be found."
"Is that a real poem?" Firion asked.
"Of course it is a real poem," Glurk said.
"But who made it, Glurk?"
Glurk closed his eyes.
"The poet, the bog, the world, and me. They are all the same thing, you know."
But he wouldn't explain what he meant. Finally, Zan threw the doors of the workshop wide open, a look of grim satisfaction on her face.
"You see," she explained to a very skeptical Glurk as she drew a large chalk circle on the ground, leaving a gap open to pass through. She drew 13 evenly spaced marks along the circumference of the circle and used them to map out the points of a 13-pointed star. "In the end, all we are doing is setting a clock. Each day ticks by like the perfect whirring of a well-tuned gear. You see?"
Glurk shook his head. He did not see. Zan marked out the time along the almost complete circle, a neat and orderly progression.
"It's a 13-year cycle. That's all the spell will allow, And less than that in our case, I'm afraid. The whole mechanism synchronizes to her own biology. Not much I can do about that. She's already 5, so the clock will set itself to 5 and will go off when she reaches 13.
Glurk squinted. None of this made any sense to him. Of course, magic itself always felt like nonsense to the swamp monster. Magic was not mentioned in the song that built the world, but rather had arrived in the world much later, in the light from the stars and moon. Magic to him always felt like an interloper, an uninvited guest. Glurk much preferred poetry. I'll be using the same principle as the protective cocoon that she sleeps in. All that magic is kept inside, but in this case it will be inside her, right at the front of her brain, behind the center of her forehead. I can keep it contained and tiny. A grain of sand. All that power in a grain of sand. Can you imagine? Glurk said nothing. He gazed down at the child in his arms. She didn't move.
It won't...
he began. His voice was thick. He cleared his throat and started again.
It won't ruin things, will it? I think I rather like her brain. I would like to see it unharmed.
Oh, piffle, Zan admonished. Her brain will be perfectly fine. At least I'm more than fairly sure it will be fine.
Zan!
Oh, I'm only kidding. Of course she will be fine. This will simply buy us some time to make sure she has the good sense to know what to do with her magic once it is unleashed. She needs to be educated. She needs to know the contents of those books there. She needs to understand the movements of the stars and the origins of the universe and the requirements of kindness. She needs to know mathematics and poetry. She must ask questions. She must seek to understand. She must understand the laws of cause and effect and unintended consequences. She must learn compassion and curiosity and awe. All of these things. We have to instruct her, Glurk. All three of us. It is a great responsibility.
The air in the room became suddenly heavy. Zan grunted as she pushed the chalk through the last edges of the 13-pointed star. Even Glurk, who normally wouldn't be affected, found himself both sweaty and nauseous.
"And what about you?" Glurk said. "Will the siphoning of your magic stop?"
Zan shrugged.
"It was slow, I expect."
She pressed her lips together.
"Little bit by bit by bit. And then she will turn 13, and it will flow out all at once. No more magic. I will be an empty vessel with nothing left to keep these old bones moving. And then I'll be gone."
Zan's voice was quiet and smooth, like the surface of the swamp, and lovely as the swamp is lovely. Glurk felt an ache in his chest. Zan attempted to smile.
"Still, if I had my druthers, it's better to leave her orphaned after I can teach her a thing or two, get her raised up properly, prepare her. And I'd rather go all at once, instead of wasting away like poor Zazimos."
"Death is always sudden," Glurk said.
His eyes had begun to itch.
"Even when it isn't."
He wanted to clasp Zan in his third and fourth arms, but he knew the witch wouldn't stand for it, so he held Luna a little bit closer instead as Zan began to unwind the magical cocoon. The little girl smacked her lips together a few times and cuddled in close to his damp chest, warming him through. Her black hair shone like the night sky. She slept deeply. Glurk looked at the shape on the ground. There was still an open walkway for him to pass through with the girl. Once Luna was in place and Glurk was safely outside the chalk rim, Zan would complete the circle and the spell would begin. He hesitated.
"You're sure, Zan?" he said. "Are you very, very sure?"
"Yes. Assuming I've done this right, the seed of magic will open on her 13th birthday. We don't know the exact day, of course, but we can make our guesses. That's when her magic will come. And that's when I will go. It's enough. I've already outlasted any reasonable allotment of life on this earth, and I'm ever so curious to know what comes next. Come, let's begin."
And the air smelled of milk and sweat and baking bread. then sharp spice and skinned knees and damp hair, then working muscles and soapy skin and clear mountain pools. And something else, too, a dark, strange, earthy smell.